the Orb, Volume 1, Number 15. Collectivism. Hello, welcome to the Orb. My name is Reed Hart. Last episode, I spoke of individualism and its relationship to property rights. It feels intuitively fair that one should own the fruits of one's labor, the creation of one's imagination. Yet the ability to realize one's vision often requires the assistance of others, whether the skills of individual craftspeople or the broader infrastructure of a society. One's ownership is necessarily diluted by the resources drawn from others and from the collective commons. If I envision an ornately carved wooden cabinet, I can create one. To do that, I first need some wood. If I cut down a tree from public land, there is no single owner to take offense. I'm a member of the public, and that tree is as much mine as anyone's. There was a time when that is exactly where I would get the wood. It sounds a little quaint to most people now, particularly urban people. We've come to think of public land, the commons, as being owned and managed by some level of government. Where did government's claim to the commons come from? It had to have come from us, the people. We live on and off of the land. As we gathered into societies, we shared the land and it met our needs. The wealth of our common resources, the land, water, and soil, were the raw materials to which we applied our labor to create private wealth. If I tilled a plot of land, that land became mine because I had invested my labor into it. We would build on land to make it ours. We simply took it from the commons without resistance. Of course, over time, there was resistance, local disputes, feuds, and eventually wars. We settled down to declaring title claims and courts to sort out disputes. What land was left unclaimed remained the commons. As villages grew up, there was an accepted understanding that some resources would remain common, shared and enjoyed by all. Even now, we accept that some things are best kept in public hands, the hands of the people, and not under private control. Fresh water holds a particular place in our sense of common ownership. It is so fundamental to life, to survival, that no one is willing to concede ownership of it to a private entity, for fear that that entity might deny one's own access to it. Rather paradoxically, our deepest individual self-interest, our own survival, drives our refusal to allow any one individual to control a resource we need. We feel safer trusting the collective to manage the resource. Basic resources like air and water are one thing. There are other resources we draw upon that serve us better when collectively owned and managed than they would be in private hands. Take roads, for instance. We collectively agree that roads are essential to a well-functioning society. We set aside land, lay the pavement, and set the rules of use as a collective. We light them, place the stop signs, and all agree on which side to drive, how to signal, and when to yield. Try to imagine how difficult it would be to get around if all the land were privately held. It's not just that road building is a big project. It is a coordinated project. Returning for a moment to individualism, the importance of the individual as the source of ideas and innovation cannot be underestimated. Building a functioning society requires a careful balance between individual initiative and the collective strength of a national will. This is a challenging balance to sustain. Departing President Dwight Eisenhower made an impressive farewell speech on January 17, 1961. Many remember it for his warning of the growing power of the military-industrial complex. But in that same speech, he offered another warning.
Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor tinkering in his shop has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research, partly because of the huge costs involved. A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society.
Big ideas require equally large resources to realize. There must be a symbiotic relationship between those who command the resources and those who design the future. Innovation requires liberty, the freedom of thought to create new things. Production of the big things requires command and control of resources to organize them into tangible benefits. Too much command results in stifling the ambition of ideas. Too much liberty cannot marshal sufficient resources. Yet wonders shall never cease. A new way of realizing big ideas has been found. Socialism, or collectivism, has a badly tarnished history, and the words have become epithets to many. The old artifacts of socialism, centralized authority, state-managed resources, forced labor assignment, and totalitarian rule, have failed badly. They crush individual aspirations and are the antithesis of individualism. But there is a new socialism in town. You aren't likely aware of it, but this podcast is delivered by a server running Apache, an open-source software package. It runs on Linux, an open-source operating system. These are packages that are so large and complex that it is unlikely a single entity could have built them using a for-profit model. Creative and talented individuals built them voluntarily. They did it because they had it in them to do. They did it because it was creating something more useful and awesome than any one person could have conceived, financed, or created alone. So you don't use Linux. Okay, how about Wikipedia or the Internet Movie Database? These were initiated by creative individuals, but were made the useful, even indispensable services they have become because of the unpaid collective contributions of tens of thousands of people who did it because it made the internet more useful for all. It starts with sharing. We all want to share our stories, our pictures, our joys, and our setbacks. Facebook, anyone? How about YouTube? Sharing serves as a foundation for higher levels of communal engagement. The second step is cooperation. People start working together towards common goals. They start to tag their individual contributions to sharing sites. These tags enable others to aggregate the pieces into groups that create new meaning and understanding. Dig and Reddit are samples of these that give shape to the myriad parts. A contributor's influence extends way beyond a lone vote, and the community's collective influence can be far out of proportion to the number of contributors. That is the whole point of social institutions. The sum outperforms the parts. Traditional socialism aimed to ramp up this dynamic via the state. Now, decoupled from government and hooked into the global digital world, this elusive force operates at a larger scale than ever before. Cooperation grows into collaboration. Ad hoc cooperation gets organized into breaking down big projects into bite-sized pieces that individuals work on independently. This is where things like Linux and Apache come from. The work-reward ratio is so out of kilter from a free market perspective. The workers do immense amounts of high market value work without being paid, that these collective efforts make no sense within capitalism. Adding to the economic dissonance, we've become accustomed to enjoying the products of these collaborations free of charge. Instead of money, the peer producers who create the stuff gain credit, status, reputation, enjoyment, satisfaction, and experience. Not only is the product free, it can be copied freely and used as the basis for new products. This new form of working and producing forms a new collectivism. While cooperation can write an encyclopedia, no one is held responsible if the community fails to reach consensus, and lack of agreement doesn't endanger the enterprise as a whole. The aim of a collective, however, is to engineer a system where responsibility for critical parts is assumed by self-directed peers, and difficult decisions, such as setting priorities, are decided by all participants. Throughout history, hundreds of small-scale collectivist groups have tried this model. The results have not been encouraging. Indeed, a close examination of the governing kernel of, say, Wikipedia, Linux, or OpenOffice shows that these efforts are further from the collectivist ideal than appears from the outside. While millions of writers contribute to Wikipedia, a small number of editors, around 1,500, are responsible for the majority of the editing. The same goes for the collectives that write code. A vast army of contributors is managed by a small number of coordinators. As Mitch Kaper, founding chair of the Mozilla Open Source Code Factory, observed, quote, "Inside every working anarchy, there's an old boy network," unquote. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. Some types of collectives benefit from hierarchy while others are hurt by it. Platforms like the internet, or democracy, intended to serve as a foundation for producing goods and delivering services, benefit from being as non-hierarchical as possible, minimizing barriers to entry and distributing rights and responsibilities equally. When powerful actors appear, the entire fabric suffers. On the other hand, organizations built to create products often need strong leaders and hierarchies to efficiently manage tactical operations and long-term strategies. Who would have believed that poor farmers could secure $100 loans from perfect strangers on the other side of the planet and pay them back? That is what Kiva does with peer-to-peer lending. Every public healthcare expert declared confidently that sharing was fine for photos, but no one would share their medical records. But patients like me, where patients pool results of treatments to better their own care, prove that collective action can trump both doctors and privacy scares. The increasingly common habit of sharing what you're thinking, what you're reading, your finances, your everything, is becoming a foundation of our culture. Doing it while collaboratively building encyclopedias, new agencies, video archives, and software in groups that span continents, with people you don't know and whose class is irrelevant, that makes political socialism seem like the logical next step. A similar thing happened with free markets over the past century. Every day, someone asked, "What can markets do?" We took a long list of problems that seemed to require rational planning or paternal government and instead applied marketplace logic. In most cases, the market solution worked significantly better. Now we're trying the same trick with collaborative social technology, applying digital socialism to a growing list of wishes, and occasionally to problems that the free market couldn't solve, to see if it works. And so far, the results have been startling. At nearly every turn, the power of sharing, cooperation, collaboration, openness, free pricing, and transparency has proven to be more practical than capitalists thought possible. Each time we try it, we find that the power of the new socialism is bigger than we imagined. The Occupy movement is noted for its leaderless collective structure. It has accomplished something. It has taken the anger expressed in the 1976 film Network,
"I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore,"
and brought it out into the street. More than that, they created the General Assembly and a consensus-based decision-making process that enables any voice that had felt excluded to have a say, to contribute to policy, a truly inclusive democracy. These are not trivial achievements. Yet when writing about the Occupy movement, the editors of the New York Observer still fall back on the traditional model of leadership by individuals. Quote, "Organizers need to figure out how to build on that success," unquote. there is still a resistance to believing something like Occupy Together could arise organically from a disaffected collective. The tragedy of the commons is fairly well known. Where there is a commonly held resource, such as an ocean fish stock, individuals may draw from that common resource for their private gain. Should enough individuals behave in this way, the stock may be completely and permanently depleted, resulting in the loss of the resource to everyone. The early response to this tragedy was enclosure, the practice of fencing off private claims from the commons. In fisheries, this became claims of territoriality over coastal waters, those that could be reached by local fishermen. Underlying this practice is the idea that the private owner, benefiting from the resource, would steward that resource to ensure their own ongoing profit. No one would rationally choose to slaughter the goose that lays golden eggs. Simply put, the commons were privatized for their own preservation. Individualism typically takes it for granted that individuals know best, and that public authority or society has the right to interfere in the person's decision-making process only when a very compelling need to do so arises, and maybe not even in those circumstances. The privatization of the commons in England led to profound social and political upheaval. An anonymous protest poet from the 17th century summed up the enclosure feeling, "They hang the man and flog the woman that steals the goose from off the common, but let the greater villain loose that steals the common from the goose." So, we have come to terms with the need for public ownership and stewardship of the commons. We rely on government regulation to protect the commons from over-exploitation. We license users of the rivers to take water or dam the flow. We license users to cut the trees and mine the earth. These regulations are expected to both draw royalties to the public purse for the benefits the common delivers to the private users, and to ensure the private users do not destroy earth, water, and air. We still may not be very good at managing these regulations, nor, more importantly, the common resources that they are intended to safeguard, but we continue to try. Preserving a commons in some form is better than the practice of dividing it all among private owners as guardians. Michael Heller coined the phrase "tragedy of the anti-commons" to describe the challenges that arise from allocating too much to private owners. As an example, he noted that after the fall of communism, in many Eastern European cities there were a lot of open-air kiosks, but also a lot of empty stores. Upon investigation, he concluded that because many different agencies and private parties had rights over the use of store space, it was difficult or even impossible for a startup retailer to negotiate successfully the use of that space. Even though all the persons with ownership rights were losing money with empty stores, and stores were in great demand, their competing interests got in the way of the effective use of space. In the same way, competing use of copyrights can prevent a product from coming to the marketplace at a reasonable price, resulting in lost royalty income for the copyright holders. For example, WKRP in Cincinnati was one of the most popular syndicated sitcoms of all time, and many television shows from that era have been successfully released on DVD. However, for many years, WKRP was not available on DVD. When it was a television program, an agreement was in place between television producers and music licensing organizations such as ASCAP and BMI, wherein a standard licensing fee was paid for each song that was played on a television show. As such, the producers could determine how much money would be paid for their use of music clips and budget accordingly. However, there is no similar standard agreement for use of music on DVDs, and producers of programs are now faced with the prospect of negotiating individually with several dozen composers. The current owner of the show, 20th Century Fox, released the show on DVD starting in the first half of 2007, using sound-alike versions of music for which they could not obtain rights. New technologies have to hack through patent and copyright thickets to create innovations that could benefit the broader society. The tragedy of the anti-commons means that, for example, the unwillingness of any one rights holder to license a competing entity can result in blocking potentially life-saving biomedical breakthroughs. It is this principle that necessitates societies to preserve a public right to expropriate private property, what in America is known as eminent domain. Without it, public benefit projects like road building, ports, or other services, even with the consent of hundreds of rights holders, could be stopped if just one opposes the project. The potential for tragedy surrounds us. Acting on our own to maximize our benefit, we may destroy common resources that we count on someone or something else to protect. If we allocate the resources to individuals, believing those individuals will guard the resource in their own self-interest, we limit the benefits of being in a social group. Just as we are neither the cat that walks alone, nor the ant that sacrifices for the colony, we need to find the middle ground of joining a social order that both protects us and nurtures us. We call these social orders civilization. That's the focus next time in The Orb. Thank you. Orb is a listener-supported presentation of Cornoble Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.